Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to the final episode in this series of Sky History's Not What You Thought You Knew. I'm your host, Dr. Fern Riddell, and while I am gutted this is the last one for now, it won't be Not What You Thought You Knew if we didn't have a unique story to end on. In this episode, we'll be talking about the Sacred Band of Thebes, an elite warrior troop from the 4th century BC, supposedly consisting of 150 pairs of male lovers. And I'll be speaking to Professor of Ancient History at the University of Warwick, James Davidson, and Professor of Classics and Ancient Mediterranean Studies at Bucknell University, Stephanie Larson. Those are experts from across the globe, and I'm really excited. But first, let's head back almost 2,400 years ago to ancient Thebes. It's late at night, and we're standing at the tomb of Iolaus, one of ancient Greece's mythical heroes. Iolaus was the lover of Heracles, who you might recognise better by his Roman name, Hercules. Here, at his tomb, amongst the flickering flames of the oil lamps, men arrive in pairs. One final stop before they head into a great battle. They're here to pledge their undying devotion, not just to the great city-state of Thebes, but also to each other. Because these soldiers are unique in the ancient world. Their bonds are not just formed in training camps and on battlefields, but also from love. But what do we mean by love in the ancient world? And when we talk about the Sacred Band of Thebes being 150 pairs of male lovers, are we referring to the definition of homosexual love that we today would understand? Thebes was one of the most important cities in ancient Greece, some might even say a rival to the powerhouse of Athens. And it's home to many legendary heroes and gods, Heracles, Dionysus, even Oedipus. And for the men and boys who lived there, their way of life was one we may be surprised at. Because here, adoration, affection, and physical desire between those of the male sex is celebrated. In fact, it informs how the city is run, its political life, and the education system of ancient Thebes. And, as we already know, its military life with the Sacred Band. One of the problematic areas with this period of history is the idea of love between older men and younger boys. Our popular consciousness understands this in very simple terms as paedophilia or abuse. So this is something we will be digging into and finding out just how true that understanding of it is. I want to understand what this world is actually like. So to add more context to the Sacred Band, I'm speaking with someone who I know will totally alter my view of the ancient world. I'm joined now by James Davidson, and he's Professor of Ancient History at the University of Warwick, specialising in the social history of ancient Greece. Now, James, the Sacred Band of Thebes is a troop of soldiers who comprised of 150 pairs of male lovers. Is this a rare thing in the ancient world, or is this very common?
The army of lovers, as it's called, is unique in Greek history, but it's based on best soldiers are going to be pairs of male lovers, like Achilles and Patroclus, or Heracles and Iolaus. So this idea of the male couple being very good at, let's say, feats of self-sacrificing gallantry, something like that. There are lots of accounts of where this comes from. Some people say it comes from people looking at the alternative, which is tribal alliances and family alliances, and that the important thing about same-sex devotion, what I call not homosexuality, but homobesottedness, you're prepared to die for this person that you're so in love with. Eros in ancient Greece is the most overblown, you know, life-changing, life-churning kind of emotion. You know, to call it love is something very pale by comparison. They think that this is a way in which you can rise above tribe and family, and perhaps for the state, for the polis. You can, another word for the army of lovers is the army of the city, the army of the polis, of the state. So that shows you a weird way in which homosexual passion can help to break down tribal, family, clan alliances in favor of a city alliance, in favor of a universal political relationship.
So it's not a case of same-sex desire being something that is hidden or hushed up as we might think of it in our most recent past. This is something that is an indelible part of ancient Greek society?
I think so. Think of all those famous people in the 19th century or the early 20th century. And you're trying to work out, you know, were they or weren't they? Did they really or didn't they? You know, all these letters. And sometimes you get a coded diary in which you think, oh gosh, right. Or someone catches a disease and you think, ah, well, in that case. But in the ancient world, we have none of that. We only have these great public displays. But the publicity is also disguising. Because, I mean, I sometimes talk about it in terms of purple smoke or pink smoke. If someone is shouting about something, you know, if they're going around performing the role of being an admirer, what we the Greeks call an erastes, it's almost a public role they've got. That doesn't necessarily mean that they really have any feelings for a particular boy. It just means that they're taking on the public role of that, of a lover. They're celebrating them for some kind of social purpose.
You've touched on this very briefly, this love of boys or a particular boy. And today we might recognise the term pederasty, which is connected to this period or is drawn from ancient Greece. Can you explain a little bit more about that and also how our modern day conceptions might find this difficult?
Well, first of all, there is the whole question of sex is important. Are we talking about people having sex with underage boys, for instance?
Is that what we're talking about?
No, what we're talking about are people following 18-year-olds around, or 18-year-olds following under 18s around, sometimes in a group, writing poems about how wonderful they are, writing, and this is a very specific formula in Athens, they will write, so-and-so is beautiful, and they'll write on a gate, outside the gate of the boy, out on the door, in the gymnasium. Sometimes we hear about them camping outside the house. Plato has a wonderful vision of a guy called Charmides, who has a, you know, it's one of his relatives, and he turns out to be an oligarch, a fascist, if you like, a right-wing revolutionary. But he turns the clock back and pictures him in his youth as this great beauty. So we think he's about 18. And everybody is admiring him. So he's in the gymnasium, he's followed around by a group of older men, and also the younger boys are staring at him as if he were a statue, as Plato says, as if he were a statue. So it's this open public culture of worshipping a particular youth.
So it's an idolization of someone's physicality or their emotions or both, the person that they are, but there isn't a physical sexual partnership between those two or a relationship between those two people, you don't think?
So the word kalos, which they use all the time, means noble in terms of, you know, your class, your status, your good character. And it also means beautiful. Sometimes they specify it, they're saying he was kalos in appearance, he was nice to look at. But normally they just leave it like kalos, we don't know. And I think they think that good people are good looking. But it is physical, it's also about the body. You know, this is a culture where in the gymnasium, people are exercising naked. So you show what a great person you are because you've got fantastic musculature. You know, you've got great pecs, you're a good person. You're from a noble family. Even in the, you know, in the Homeric epics, people said, gosh, you're so good looking. You must come from a good family, you know? Whereas the opposite word, aiskros, means shameful, ugly, and low class. So there's this constant mixing of these three things, but the body is definitely there. So one of comedy's cousins says to Socrates in the narrative of Plato, well, Socrates, let me tell you, if you saw him naked, you would forget about his face. His body is so stunning. And they use the same word stunning, ekklesis. You know, you're going to have your mind blown by this body, all wrapped up in eros. So yes, it's definitely physical.
So we have this idea of the ancient Greeks as some of the forefathers of modern thought, of a golden time in history. Is it actually that part of the society is just deeply shallow? Or is it, if they, with this fascination of the body and the idealization of youth and beauty and physicality, is, I mean, in many ways, this is something we would very much recognize about as an issue in our modern society.
Well, where does it come from? You know, the Greek word gymnasium, you know, is what started out, you know, the whole movement of the Olympics in the end of the 19th century, the whole body culture. From the end of the 19th century, those, you know, old-fashioned photographs where people are posing as if they were Greek statues with little fig leaves tied over their genitals. The whole body culture also, you know, is a Greek revival in lots of ways.
Eugene Sandown, the very famous bodybuilder of the late 19th century, who dressed as if he was a Greek statue.
That's right. So there was, I mean, sometimes it's like an alibi for people to look at, you know, sexy men pretending that it's all, you know, kind of appreciation of Greek culture, as Oscar Wilde might have referred to it.
So if we have this part of Greek society that is the celebration of late adolescence, young men, young sort of older boys, where does the shift come to the Sacred Band of Thebes, where we know that this is men who are sharing physical love as well, and who are talked about as lovers? Is there an age of consent in Greek society, or is it are relationships with very young boys frowned on, or is it something that's accepted with older men? I have so many questions about this.
The fundamental thing to recognize, I think, is that ancient Greek societies, almost all of them that we can know of, are organized around age in a kind of very formal tribal way, if you like. They don't have birthdays in the way that we recognize them. The calendar is all over the place. It's a lunar solar calendar. And for that reason, or for any other reason, they're not really obsessed with birth dates. So what seems to happen is that in Athens, at least, when you think you're 18, you have to go to your village, you have to go to your parish, and you present yourself naked, or I guess your family presents you naked in the parish, and they say, we think he's 18, do you agree? And they say, okay, he's 18. And then they send him to the city council, and they have to say, okay, we agree he's 18. And if they say, no, he's not, they will fine the parish.
Wow.
Because, you know, they might want to inherit early or something like that. It's quite important. And then people dispute this, but I think it's pretty certain that everybody has their birthday at the same time, i.e. at New Year. At the beginning of the Athenian calendar, which is in the midsummer, everyone who's 18 becomes a single age class. It's like being at school, yes?
Mm.
You're in a year. And that carries on until you retire at the age of 60. So you can't hold any office, you can't become a general, you can't sit on a jury until you're 30. And the formula for those who are rejected by the council is go back to boys. So we know that boys is paides, can be a very specific name for under 18s. But it's also used in the way that we use it. Boys are anybody who's young. So the under 18s the technical official group of boys are protected by law about who they're allowed to mix with. So even the 18-year-olds are not allowed to go into the gymnasium and talk to the boys. They even have special slaves who are called pedagogues, paidagogoi, which means boy escorts. And they're chaperones, and they are there to protect the boys from unwanted attention. Not so much that they're going to have, you know, they're going to be raped or something like that, but they're going to be seen to be alone with people. So just like, I always think the comparison is like women in a Jane Austen novel. Seen alone together, you know, well, that's damaging to your reputation. So you have to, so this what Plato talks about in the Symposium is this great, what he calls a complicated paradox, which is that you're supposed to admire them, you're supposed to follow them around, you're supposed to say how beautiful they are, but at the same time, the boys are protected fiercely by these slaves, by these laws about who's allowed to see who in the gymnasium. It's all very complicated.
So where do same-sex relationships then fit? Is that something that happens in your 20s and your 30s, that you might form an attachment to another man or an older man?
So first of all, you have these different kinds of relationship. You have this pack, what I call the wolf pack of admirers, yes, which we see in Plato's comedies, elsewhere. This is literally a group of people following you around, saying how wonderful you are. It's a weird custom. The Romans thought it was very weird. And then you have one-on-ones, then you have relationships. So-and-so is so-and-so's admirer. And when Plutarch is talking about the Sacred Band of Thebes, Plutarch, who's a writer from the Roman period, but is a local boy, he's from very close to Thebes. He talks about this institution of the Sacred Band. Almost everything we know is from this single author, single text. And he says that he knows a piece of Aristotle, who's much earlier, saying that they would pledge themselves at the tomb of Heracles' boyfriend, Iolaus. So we know that that is a one-to-one partnership, if you like. So that's another kind of relationship. And those must be somehow formalized, institutionalized. We hear about different rituals in Crete, for instance, where there's a kind of mock kidnapping. And the boy is kidnapped. And then the two, both the admirer who's been allowed to kidnap the boy in this mock tug of war, and the boy who's been allowed to be kidnapped in this mock tug of war, are given special titles and special clothes to wear. So they're recognized by society. So these are political relationships. And when Plato talks about, I think this is one of the great misreadings of ancient Greek homosexuality. So Plato, in a long passage, talks about what is the right way for someone to yield to a lover. You know, so they're importuning them, they're saying how wonderful they are. When is it right to put out, if you like? And he concludes that the only reason to put out is for the sake of virtue. And so everyone says, ah, so really it's all about virtue, it's all about virtue. But it's clear, reading between the lines, that normally that is not what happens. Normally, and Plato elaborates it, he says it's for virtue. It's not for political advancement, it's not for money. And the implication is that normally it's for political advantage and it's for money. So you make a very good attachment that will last you a long time. Now then, you might get married.
I was going to ask, what is this? So we have this idea of, you have young boys who are admired, who may pick up a what we might understand as a wealthy patron or someone who could advance them. That connection remains a lifelong one. And throughout that time, they may also marry, they may become, they may see a sexuality that is much broader. I mean, are we talking about bisexuality here? Is that really what ancient Greece is? Is just an entire state of bisexuals?
Well, yes, but in a way that's because you're assuming this, you know, sense of sexual orientation. If it's an institution, if it's something which is really important for your future, if everyone's doing it in this public way, we don't know what happens behind closed doors. All we know is that people are writing poems, saying how beautiful someone is physically. then there's nothing to preclude you also having children, marrying. In some cases, we know that the marriage, the heterosexual marriage, follows the same sex, the homosexual association. And I think no one would disagree that ancient Greece is a patriarchal society. But the fact that men are also sexually objectified, you know, in the same way that women are normally sexually objectified through the rest of history, if you like, does mean that there's an interesting, that the whole kind of men versus women is more complicated in ancient Greece. That there's, you know, it's the them and us is also a us and us. Do you see what I mean? So one of the earliest references to rape, to a legal definition of rape in our terms, normally rape means kidnap, yes? Rapere, to snatch, in Greek, harpazein. But the first definition we have is from Crete, law code in Gorton, and it has the definition, anyone who has sex by force with someone. So it's the first definition of sex by rape as sex by force. And it says, with a man or with a woman. So there's this weird kind of gender equality or gender substitution, which comes out of this Greek homosexuality, which I think people have not really thought about as much, that there's a kind of, they are seen as two sides of the same coin, if you like. And the men who are objectifying women, the courtesans especially, have themselves been objectified, they know what it's like to be a sex object, if you like.
To go back to the Sacred Band of Thebes for my last question, how were they seen in ancient Greece society? Were they the pinnacle of achievement? Were they celebrated, or were they something that was a surprise?
This is a very difficult question because there's very little information about the Sacred Band of Thebes. So although they're very famous for us, as I say, almost all of our information comes from Plutarch, writing, you know, how many years? 400 years after the last gasp, the Battle of Chaeronea. One important thing he says is that when Philip of Macedon, Alexander's father, having slaughtered them, having kind of eradicated the Sacred Band of Thebes, was walking over the battlefield, he said, shame on anyone who thinks that these men are doing anything shameful. So he was celebrating them, and we're all thinking like, what shameful thing might they be suspecting? So he's celebrating them as they were.
I think one of the things that James has made really clear is this idea of an age of consent. The fact that the boys under the age of 18 were considered protected in ancient Thebes. And this is an idea or concept we can understand very much today. Consent around sex and the age of consent has always been important to us. In fact, here in the UK, it was the Victorians who fought very hard to make sure the age of consent was raised from just 13 to 16 in 1885. So, knowing that boys under the age of 18 were protected also removes any arguments that some might try to make for the ancient Greeks supporting paedophilia. That's just another example of how history can be corrupted by popular misunderstanding and the truth lost. So, here's what we've learned so far about ancient Thebes and the Sacred Band. Society was patriarchal, men idolised and obsessed over one another, and relationships were often formed between older and younger men that were seen as educational, political and economically beneficial. And finally, that these relationships could include physical and emotional connection. I love the term James used there, that of homobesottedness between men, and it does leave me wondering what life was like for women in this city. But I think that's a subject we're going to have to leave until our next series. So now we know more about ancient Thebes, I want to know more about the evidence for its famous warriors. Plato, one of our most famous ancient Greeks and a founding father of Western thought, wrote, "If there were only some way of contriving that a state or an army should be made up of lovers and their beloved, they would be the very best governors of their own city, abstaining from all dishonour and emulating one another in honour. And when fighting at each other's side, although a mere handful, they would overcome the world. For what lover would not choose rather to be seen by all mankind than by his beloved, either when abandoning his post or throwing away his arms. He would be ready to die 1,000 deaths rather than endure this. For who would desert his beloved or fail him in the hour of danger? That sounds a lot like the sacred band to me. So to add more context to this legend, I have someone who has led an archaeological team to excavate the Temple of Apollo in Thebes in 2013, uncovering graves, a garbage pit, and various other important items to our understanding of the sacred band and the wider world of ancient Greece.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
I'm joined now by Stephanie Larson, and she's a professor of classics and ancient Mediterranean studies at Bucknell University and co-directs the Thebes Sinaia Gassia excavation project. Stephanie, thank you so much for joining me today. Now, the Sacred Band of Thebes are an elite troop consisting of 150 pairs of male lovers and were formed in the 4th century BC. Can you tell me a little about what Theban culture and society was like at that time?
One thing I want to mention at the outset is that we don't know that much about the sacred band. We don't know that much about its composition. And so a lot of the sources that we have for this particular military group are much later. So in fact, the sources that mention Theban military groups and the real importance of them are very difficult to assess. They date much later than the sacred band was supposed to have been formed. Our main source is Plutarch, and he was from the area around Thebes. He was from a town called Chaeronea. So he was very pro-Theban. He was also elaborating in his histories. And he often dates to, he does date to the later part of the 1st century CE. So this is over 400 years after the events that he discusses. And so it'd be like you telling a story about something that happened 400 years ago. How much can we really trust you to tell the truth? In a way, the foundational underpinnings of the sacred band and our knowledge of them are extremely insecure.
Well, should the question I should really be asking you then, first off, is, did the sacred band of Thebes really exist?
Right. That's a good question. That's a very good question. I would say that the sacred band of Thebes probably existed. I would say that the sacred band of Thebes probably didn't exist in the way that we might like to imagine them existing because of later elaborations on their story and later use of the story of homoerotic military people, the fascination that we might have even in today's times, because we're actually much more repressed sexual culture than the Greek culture was. And so we've sort of become fascinated by this idea of men in the military who might be gay. But gay is not a word that we can use of ancient people at all, because they didn't think of the world in sort of these dichotomies, gay, not gay, gay, straight, etc. The sexuality of ancient Greece was on a sort of continuum. And there were men who had gay relationships, homosocial relationships, homosexual relationships, and also heterosexual relationships. And so it's not a thing that we necessarily want to focus on too much. I mean, in making that the only defining characteristic of the sacred band, in other words. The real thing to remember actually about the sacred band is that they were the first paid military force that we really know of from Boeotia, which is the area around Thebes, the sort of region of Thebes. And because we know more about the sort of ad hoc military formations in antiquity, and most soldiers in antiquity were citizen soldiers or farmers, and they were soldiers part of the time, but not all the time. And so the sacred band is a really interesting phenomenon because it's one of the first that we know of a sort of professional standing army that was trained and sort of housed in the city state itself and paid for by the state, and so that they're professionals. We had mercenary soldiers too in antiquity, but they're not as they're not the same as kind of the sacred band. So that's one thing to remember about them. That's actually the most important Greek historical point about the sacred band. It's not the homosocial nature of the supposed nature of the sacred band.
So let's go back to the very, very beginning of this conversation and really set the scene. Where is Thebes in the 4th century? And I know that seems like such a silly question to ask, but what is the world like, and where does Thebes sit in it culturally and socially?
The 4th century is a complicated century. The Peloponnesian War had just finished, and Sparta had just defeated Athens in this long protracted war at the end of the 5th century. And after the defeat of Athens by Sparta and the allies in the Peloponnesian War, we find ourselves in this century where it seems to me like so many Greek city-states are just constantly vying for power. They're in various parts of this century. One is called the Corinthian War in the beginning of the century, where Sparta is pitted against some of the allies, Athens and Thebes ally together, and Corinth and Argos, and Persia even allies together against Sparta because they don't want Sparta to become too powerful. And so one of the themes of the 4th century is you have all these shifting alliances between city-states in order to try to prevent one or the other from becoming more powerful, either Athens or Thebes or Sparta, and all of these other tiny little places that are allying back and forth with them. So it's a very chaotic period, it's very complicated. There was a peace in the beginning of the 4th century called the King's Peace that Persia had sort of brokered between the Greek city-states. And that was very dangerous for Thebes, if we're going to talk about Thebes mostly, because that peace called the King's Peace from the King of Persia declared that Persia would control all of what's now Turkey, Ionia, and declare that all the other city-states would become autonomous, which means, you know, they would be ruling themselves. They couldn't form leagues, they couldn't form alliances, they couldn't form coalitions with themselves. And Sparta was supposed to be the guardian of this peace, right? And had the power to enforce the clauses of this peace. So Sparta was a little bit in power at the beginning of the 4th century. And Sparta went up to Thebes and installed a garrison there. Which was very detrimental, right, to Thebes, and they exiled a bunch of people that were anti-Spartan, and they also killed a number of other people in Thebes who were anti-Spartan. So in the beginning of the 4th century, everybody's kind of pretty exhausted. Sparta has been put into this position of power of being the law enforcer for a Persian brokered peace, which is interesting. And all of these exiles from Thebes go down to Athens, and they sort of decide to foment revolt. One of them is the famous Boiotarch, which is the head Boeotian, one of the head Boeotian figures named Pelopidas. And he goes down to Athens, and he comes back a few years later and basically liberates the city from Athens. They install a democracy, which is not something that Thebes is known for. Usually Thebes is kind of an oligarchic government, but they install maybe a democracy. Then for the next few decades, Thebes tries to become more powerful, and it essentially does do this pretty successfully. It goes down into the Peloponnese, it has a bunch of military campaigns, which we can talk about in a minute. It goes up to Thessaly, which is north of Thebes, a region north of Thebes, and tries to sort of ally itself with a coalition of Thessalian cities. But really, in this time, you've got just these city-states vying for power. Thebes is becoming more preeminent than it has in the historical period, but it's very short-lived.
Can you give me a bit of background into how the Sacred Band of Thebes came to be formed? Because you're describing this really warlike, exciting, shifting sands kind of a place. How do people decide that they need to have professional soldiers?
Traditionally, the date of the Sacred Band is in the early 4th century, like 379, 378. And this is right after the Spartans' garrison is kicked out. So perhaps that the Thebans thought they needed to protect their citadel, right? And they needed to have a standing army for that. So this is a very disruptive time. It's probably a dangerous time for them. We do have evidence that from earlier historians before 379, that there were some sort of select Thebans. There were 300 Thebans at the Battle of Plataea in 479 against the Persians. There are indications that there may have been a group of 300 kind of soldiers before the early 4th century, but they're never called the Sacred Band at that point. Most of the sources don't even, in fact, use the name Sacred Band.
How does the name the Sacred Band come about?
Sometimes they're known as the City Band in one source, but the Sacred Band may have something to do with the fact that is recorded again in this late source, Plutarch, that in Thebes, male lovers and their younger lovers, they would go to a sacred shrine of Iolaus, who's a character from mythology, who was from Thebes. He was the nephew of Heracles, who was also from Thebes in mythology. And Heracles and Iolaus used to hang out together. And it was reported by later sources that they were lovers, although they are actually also related. But that's kind of interesting because Thebes has a lot of incestual mythology in the city. The lovers of Thebes used to go, according to these late sources, down to the sanctuary and basically swear their fidelity to the other, or make sort of a pledge to each other, pledging some sort of love in your relationship. It's not really love either. I mean,
I was going to ask you about this, because when we say lovers and sexuality, we understand that in very controlled terms.
So in ancient Greece as a whole, especially in the 6th century BC, in the 5th century BC, and more also into the 4th century, and we're not sure how long this lasted, there was basically pederastic male relationships that were considered to be normal and expected between an older man and a younger boy. Not too young. So the younger boy is about, well, possibly verging on the age of going into the military. So mid-teens to late teens. So possibly 17, 18, et cetera, 15 maybe. I mean, it depends. We're not really sure. And every city-state, like I said, is a little bit different. And the older man is already established in the aristocratic families. He's already established as a soldier. He's already established possibly as a political force in the city state. And he is basically going to be the mentor to this younger man. And they're known by the Greek terms eromenos, which means the beloved one, and the erastes, which means the lover, the one who does the loving. And this relationship was really important for the young boy who comes from an aristocratic family. This is very class specific, if you can talk about class in ancient Greece anyway. And so this relationship is very important for this boy, because this relationship brings connections between the two families and between a sort of a networking experience for this young boy. And in this relationship, it is partly sexual, and there is definitely touching. We have lots of literary sources for this. We have lots of vase paintings that show this, actually. But it's not just about sex. It's about also teaching about philosophy, teaching about politics, teaching possibly even about music and poetry especially, and that kind of thing. So it's very much part of the sexual continuum of ancient Greece. And the men in these relationships wouldn't have called themselves gay or homosexual, because they were also expected the older ones were expected to get married and have children and to have, you know, heterosexual relationships as well. And usually there was an end point to these relationships. So this was a gift in a way to the young boy, in his terms of his education. And as soon as he got old enough, then that relationship would be finished. They would be considered to be old lovers. But it's very interesting for us to think about these kinds of relationships that are so different from what we would call normal. And in fact, we would call this relationship in our modern societies mostly pederastic. Kind of horrified by this, but it was totally considered to be normal.
I'm an expert on Victorian sexuality, and I know how hard, just in the 19th century, we have to work to try and get people to understand that sex Sexual ideas and attitudes shift and change and aren't bound by the boundaries that we put them in today, especially when we're looking back in the past. But what fascinates me about your period, about this period in the ancient world, is we really struggle to really grasp what's happening at this time. And historians ourselves can get quite touchy about how this era is displayed. Because if we talk about pederasty, there's an instant connection for a lot of people to pedophilia and the idea that this sexual relationship is something that is morally abhorrent to us in a modern world. Do you think that's possibly why some historians have verged far more on the idea that these relationships are somehow noble because they believe there was no touching or no sexual contact, and that actually the reality, as you've said, from the vases, from everything else, shows us that there was, and we just have to understand that the past is a very different place?
Oh, absolutely. The past, as it's been said by various historians, ancient historians and anthropologists, is a foreign country. Mm-hmm. And we have, since the Victorian period especially, sort of extolled the ancient Greeks as being these noble, amazing philosophers who were just kind of sitting around thinking about all these wonderful thoughts about excellence and beauty and virtue. Well, in fact, they were just regular people. And they also had different roles and different rules for their sexualities. So we really have to understand that the world was a very different place then, and their cultural rules were very different than ours. I would hate to think of the idea of someone thinking that it was pedophilia. I mean, that is a Greek word, the love of the boy, the love of the child. But it was pederasty in a sense of institutionalized education. So the focus wasn't only on the sexuality, that's the thing. And that's, I think, one of the legacies of the Victorian period, is that we are obsessed with the idea of any sort of sexuality that still deviates from what some people consider to be the norm. One of the foremost scholars who's written most on the sacred band is David Lateo from the San Francisco State University. And he's actually argued that it would make no sense to have an eromenos erastes relationship, a beloved and a lover relationship, involved in the same military unit. Because from an age perspective, at a 17 or 18 year old person, 20 year old person, and a 30 or, you know, early 30s person, this doesn't make sense from a military standpoint.
Well, so has this come about? Basically, what's happened is we know that sources tell us in Theban culture that the part of the education system of young men was that they would form this connection that was both sexual and educational with an older man in their life. And also then that Thebes had a band of warriors who were professional, who were incredibly successful at some points, and that throughout the centuries and throughout people's excitement and interest in history, those two worlds have just become mashed together. And so the idea that the Sacred Band of Thebes were a pairs of gay lovers doesn't actually have any basis in history at all.
It doesn't have much, that's true. Now, one of the things David Lateo has suggested is they could be former lovers, former pairs, or pairs of former lovers, which would make a lot more sense. They would still have a bond together. They would still be very close together. And ancient Greek sources from elsewhere talk about the bond that an older lover and a young beloved had for the life, but it wasn't considered to be a sexual bond anymore after that original sort of institutionalized educational period was over. And so I think we could see the sacred band as pairs of lovers, but possibly, as Lateo suggests, pairs of former lovers. And that makes a lot of sense. And if we think about also the friendships that people who fight with each other have, it might be more useful for us to think about that kind of relationship as well, grafted onto the former lover category, right? So these men now are progressing on in their lives, in their military lives, and they are fighting with each other side by side. And when you do that, you develop, you know, the band of brothers kinds of mentality, which is very well documented in psychological literature and military literature from contemporary times all the way back. So you can think of these people as being very close, as elite corps often are anyway. You know, think of the Marines, a band of Marines that goes to war together, or any other elite corps from any other country. You know, they come back and those are their people. You know, those are their family. They will not do anything to betray them. They will always support them. And so I think it might be more useful to think about the sacred band in this way, as a sacred core of very elite warriors who had previous relationships but are now fighting together. And they're from the same city, so they also have the same sort of civic identity.
Is the notion of the sacred band being made up of pairs of old lovers or current lovers or men who are incredibly tightly bonded, is this something that is commented on by other Greek cities or by other people looking at Thebes at this time? Is it something that is seen as unusual, or is it common? Is we're talking about Thebes as a very specific city-state here, but is this notion of bonding and male education and male sexuality one that's shared across ancient Greece at this time?
I think it's shared across ancient Greece, absolutely. And for example, as you talk about the sources, the military historian Xenophon, who is the closest source in time to Theban military affairs of the 4th century and Spartan military affairs and everything, he does not say anything specific about an erotic Theban army. Even though he devotes tons of information and pages to the activity of the Theban military during this 4th century time, from 375 to 362. Now, you could say that that's maybe because he thought he wanted to, he was an anti-Theban, he was pro-Spartan. But there are other pro-Theban sources that don't mention the sacred band either as an erotic band. So it doesn't seem to be a thing that was really truly an obsession with any writer at this time. And the fact that, pederastic relationships were kind of expected in common in aristocratic circles across ancient Greek city-states leads me to believe that it really wasn't a big deal. And the later sources that mention the erotic nature of the sacred band are kind of utopian sources. And Lyteo has argued this. They're talking about the relationship between lovers and the support of democracy and lovers and fighting against tyranny. There's a famous story from Athenian history in which the two lovers, Harmodius and Aristogiton, actually kill one of the old kings in early Athenian history. And so they were supposedly lovers. And so there's a lot of situating in literature of homosocial men fighting against tyranny. And so it becomes a trope, it becomes a theme of literature and not necessarily a reflection of reality.
How did the sacred band come to an end, and why don't we still have them today?
The sacred band fought in a number of battles in the 4th century that we know of, in which Thebes and Boeotia in general became really quite prominent. They call it the Theban hegemony. Hegemony is a little bit of an overused term. The Theban hegemony lasted only 9 years, according to the major historical periods, but whatever. And after they had established this sort of decade of power in Greece, they had to reckon on the ground with the power of Macedon under Philip II, who was Alexander the Great's father. And he had been gaining power in the last part of the 4th century. And he had been solving some problems for major Greek city-states that had always been fighting with each other since the end of the Peloponnesian War. And so he was gathering allies, and people knew that he was very powerful. And so they were allying themselves with him. But he came down to central Greece because some of his friends that he had just made, some of his allies, appealed to him because they were sparring with the Thebans over some territories in central Greece. And so Philip uses this appeal as an excuse to come down into central Greece. And he finds the army of the allies, including Thebes and the Sacred Band, waiting for him at a place called Chaeronea. And this is in 338. And Chaeronea is a really, really amazing place because it's a valley, essentially. It's a big, broad valley about 3 miles across. And it's like the pass into southern Greece, the central part of southern Greece. And so this is where they have to stand in order to prevent them from coming. It's sort of like Thermopylae was to the Greeks in the Persian Wars. And so Philip comes down. He's got 30,000 infantry. He's a huge force. He's got a lot of cavalry as well. He also has a different kind of weaponry. He has a very long spear called a sarissa, which is twice as long as the normal Greek hoplite spear. So that's very damaging. and so they basically fight together with the Thebans and their allies. And Philip is on the right fighting the Athenians, who are allied with Thebes at the time. And he sets his son Alexander, who's later to become Alexander the Great, on the left, and they fight the so-called Sacred Band on the left. And Philip feigns a withdrawal, and so the Athenians kind of follow him, and then the cavalry sort of attacks the Sacred Band on the other side. And supposedly, this is where the Sacred Band is annihilated by Alexander the Great and his fellow general. We have some really interesting evidence for this, just that just was published this year. And I'd like to mention Mariah Liston, who's a very good osteologist. She has gone, we work with her at our excavation in Thebes too. And she's looking at our skeletons because we have a cemetery above the temple. Anyway, she's doing all of our work here on our skeletal material. But she has recently published, in fact, I think it's just out maybe for a month, the skeletal material that was saved from the Battle of Chaeronea in 338. The original excavators, I believe it was, I can't remember what year, in the early 19th century, they excavated the burial site of supposedly the Theban burials. And they saved some of the bone material. They unfortunately threw away a lot of it, but they saved what they thought was the most impressive bone material from that. And they found seven rows of 254 skeletons, very well known, that's marked today with the Lion of Chaeronea. You may have seen pictures of this. And Mariah Liston has analyzed these heads, crania mostly, and leg pieces. And she's found some really cool things. These damage was very traumatic to the crania of these people. She's analyzed a lot of different heads. All of them have, all but one have blunt force trauma in the sort of time around death. There's blows to the faces with objects like rims of shields. You can identify cuts through actual crania with long, straight, heavy blades like swords. So there's this one particular cranium of a Theban that has actually been slashed from the frontal bone on the near the hairline. And it went all the way back down through the head, behind the eyes, to the nose, to the top of the jaw, and removed the whole brain case in the upper face. So this guy was kind of like defaced completely. And he would have been.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. And it's just been published. And the picture is amazing. It's on the cover of a book. The book is called, it's a collection of new approaches to Greek and Roman warfare, new approaches to Greek and Roman warfare from 2020. And it's edited by a man named Lee Bryce, who's an American military historian. Anyway, so that's where this article appears. And that head of that person that was defaced with the sword is on the cover of that volume. But the most interesting part of this is not the gore and all that kind of stuff. But the most interesting part of this is that Mariah has shown that these people were actually attacked from above. And so this proves, I think, without a doubt, really, that what the ancient sources said was true, that Alexander the Great with his cavalry, attacked the hoplite phalanx of the Sacred Band or the Thebans, however you want to call them. And so they are being all attacked from the top. All of the skull injuries are shown to be attacks from the top. Or if they weren't on the horses, if Alexander wasn't on the horses, then the Thebans were actually on their knees. And so all of these injuries are coming from the top, which is fascinating. Anyway, so this is brand new, newly published evidence that the Sacred Band was really decimated, like the ancient sources do say, at the Battle of Chaeronea with Philip II in charge, and they were all buried there.
So if the Sacred Band ends then, or we around that time, what happens to Thebes next? And also, what happens to Greek sexuality? I mean, is the idea of these sacred lovers, is it one that continues into later Greek life, or does it fade at the same time?
Well, I don't think it has a relationship per se to the Sacred Band. And the destruction of the Sacred Band. I would say that Greek sexuality is always going to be more open and free, ancient Greek sexuality, than ours is for sure. But the idea of a pederastic aristocratic relationship does not last much further on in Greek history. It's a lot different later. And so you want to think about this ancient pederastic relationship that's happening in the sort of 6th to 5th to mid to late 4th century. And then really things change and the whole Greek world is put up into upheaval. After Alexander, things get crazy and chaotic. And there's a lot of cosmopolitanism as well in this part of the world by this time. So the old way of Greek aristocratic pederasty is on the wane, I would have to say. But that isn't to say that it is replaced by something that resembles the kinds of obsessive, sort of strict sexualities that many people in modern culture think are the right ways. Of course, Alexander himself, I think, was reputed and known to have male lovers. And Alexander then, with Thebes, he comes down later and he uses Thebes as an example. Though the archaeological evidence doesn't really suggest that he razed it to the ground at that point. But we, like I said, we don't have a systematic excavation of all of Thebes. And so after Thebes was destroyed by Alexander, it never really regained any of its historical power until the Middle Ages. It became a much more economic and powerful force again 1,000 years later.
Stephanie raises some fantastic points about whether the relationships between men and the sacred band of Thebes can be understood within our limited definitions of sexuality today. And it's both tantalizing and frustrating to hear that so much archaeological evidence lies hidden under modern Thebes now. Who knows what glorious finds are still to come, and just how much evidence of the sacred band could be lying there waiting for us. But even if these elite warriors aren't with us today, their legacy has not been forgotten. The name the Sacred Band was revived by Greece for the first organized military resistance to the Ottoman Empire during the Greek War of Independence in 1821. Greece had been under Turkish rule since the 15th century, and their fight for independence drew interest and support from the three great powers, Britain, Russia, and France. Even Lord Byron, bringing with him huge amounts of money, arrived in Greece hoping to aid the cause. He died there in 1824, 6 years before the war ended. So perhaps what we should be asking ourselves about the Sacred Band of Thebes is not just questions around how our attitudes to sexuality have changed over time, but also how long our memories are. Because while ancient Greece might seem like a very foreign country, the idea of a standing army to protect your liberties and your values is one we have never been able to be without. Even today, thousands of years later, human society has not moved on from its warlike and destructive nature. And how bizarre is it that in comparison to today, where gay men and our gay youth still risk death and violence in their modern societies just for existing, in the ancient Greek world, to be attracted to another consenting man was not unusual or hidden, but celebrated. As always, it seems the past has a lot to teach us. So that's it for our last episode of this series of Not What You Thought You Knew, sponsored by Ancestry. What has been your favourite episode of this series? I really want to know. Drop it in a review on your podcast app or share it on social media using the hashtag NotWhatYouThought. And head to skyhistory.co.uk to find out more info on all of our episodes, including heaps of historical articles, competitions, and the latest on Sky History's TV shows. And finally, a big thank you to my guests, Professor James Davidson and Professor Stephanie Larson. This episode of Not What You Thought You Knew was hosted by me, Dr. Fern Riddell, produced by Kim Sargent and Pete Ross, with research by Mary Unze, and our series producer is Sam Pearson.
History's Letters of Love in World War II reveals a remarkable account of the Second World War through a series of real-life love letters.
Featuring interviews with their family and starring me, Johnny Pitts,
and me, Amy Nuttall. This 8-part podcast series tells the brave, tenacious, and touching story of Cyril and Olga's war.
We found a place to park our tanks, climbed out, just gonna start a fire to make a meal when, phew, bang, one shell dropped about 20 yards one side of the tank, another about the same the other side.
I'm dreaming of those 3 happy months we spent together at home. How quickly they flew. It'll be like a second honeymoon when we start that life again.
Download Letters of Love in World War II on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Acast.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Are you obsessed with the trials and tribulations of the rich and famous? Do you live for the drama of a legal investigation? Same. If you're up on your Agatha Christie, were glued to Gwyneth Ski and Run trial, and tweeted Free Britney, courtroom drama's made for you. I'm Jackie Adedeji, your host. Think of me as a British raven-haired Elwoods. What, like it's hard? In this podcast series, I'm delving deep into real-life celebrity court cases. Yep, everything we're talking about actually happened. We like to keep things authentic around here, so you'll hear actors voicing the actual transcripts from the celebrity trials.
This conservatorship is doing me way more harm than good.
Well, I lost half a day of skiing.
It's Rebecca Vardy's account.
I'll be getting into exactly what went down in each case with a fully qualified barrister, discussing the debates that were dominating our timelines with respective experts. We've read the court transcripts so you don't have to. So, what are you waiting for? Search for Courtroom Drama on your favourite podcast app and hit follow. It's almost time to get served.